The plastic does not give you that sense of security that the metal does.
You need a six-legged chair.
Okay. I told you on Thursday, this is the once over lightly. Thursday we did the introduction to some of the philosophical concepts and relationships between women and men, roles, Jewish roles. Today, we're going to look briefly at some of the legal issues. And again, as on Thursday, those who wish to continue the discussion are invited to do so in the second hour at 4:30 upstairs in the library. Because if I stop for the entire debate now, I'll never get finished with the basic material. First point is this. We said on Thursday that the verse in Genesis stating that husband rules over wife is a curse, and as a curse, it is something which is not a mitzvah and not an inescapable reality, but rather a tendency which should be avoided to whatever extent possible. It's not a norm, it's an anti-norm. And I said at that time that there are many laws which are designed to prevent the husband from ruling over the wife. Here are a few of them. Residence. If it's a question of moving from one place to another place outside the land of Israel, no move is made unless both husband and wife agree. If it's a question of moving from outside the land of Israel to the land of Israel, either spouse can compel the other spouse to agree or be penalized. The same is true with moving from any place in the land of Israel to Jerusalem. Either spouse can compel the other spouse. There's absolute equality in determining where living shall take place. Money. How is money managed in a marriage? There are two possible arrangements. Arrangement number one, the husband has sole responsibility for supporting the family. Under those conditions, if the wife should earn money, her money goes to the husband. That's arrangement number one. Arrangement number two, husband earns and keeps his money. Wife earns and she keeps her money. And they share the expenses of the family. The wife alone determines which arrangement applies. It's her prerogative. Because the husband has the responsibility to support the family. So she can say, listen, I'm not doing this. You do it. It's your responsibility. If she chooses to put all the responsibility on her husband, then the money that she earns goes to him. But she doesn't have to do that. If she wants, she can earn her own, have her own bank account, and contribute her share of the expenses. Third, when a man dies, his wife has no share in the inheritance. A wife does not inherit her husband. In place of that, she has a lien on the estate, a lien that must be paid prior to all inheritance. Her lien precedes inheritance. Her lien includes support at the level that she was enjoying when the husband died until she gets married, remarried, or a lump sum settlement at her choice. She can take a lump sum settlement if she wants to go into business, or she can take support. That has to be present before any inheritance takes place. And the Mishnah says explicitly that if there isn't enough money to go around, she gets paid first, and if there are sons who should inherit and can't because there isn't enough money, the Mishnah says, let them beg. The wife comes first. If a couple gets married, a man has a biblical obligation to pay regular sexual attention to his wife. How much is regular? Depends on the husband's profession. If he's an accountant, it's one thing. If he's a sailor, it's another thing. The sailor is away from home for long periods of time. What happens if after the marriage takes place and the frequency of sexual attention is set, the husband wants to change his job. He's tired of being an accountant, wants to go to sea. The wife can stop it. She can say, well, we got married, we had this arrangement, you cannot change the arrangement unless you can maintain the same level of sexual attention. Now, I think you can understand from these laws that it'll be very difficult for the husband to rule over his wife with these laws in place. This is just a sampling to give you an idea of how the law is structured. Now,
what stops the wife from ruling over her husband?
Oh, good question. We'll leave that aside for the moment. What stops the wife from ruling over the husband? Very good. Now, there are areas of Jewish law in which a combination of ignorance of the totality of the law, together with faulty logic and stirring a little political prejudice, leads to gross misrepresentation, gross distortion of the Torah's point of view on crucial subjects. I'm going to consider two at length. I'd like 10 or 15 minutes. That's study of Torah and testimony. All of this comes from Eisenman's book, as I told you last time. Jewish Woman and Jewish Law by Moshe Meisman, which is the classic on the subject. And then we will talk about the decision procedure, that laws are decided by scholars who are male, whether that's an inherently prejudicial situation. And those are the topics that I want to cover. Let's take study of Torah. You will hear it said that women are forbidden to study Torah. Now, why would that be? It's got to be because women are dumb. What other reason could there be for saying that women are forbidden to study Torah? And therefore, you see that the Jewish tradition regards women as incurably dumb. Mm-hmm. What are the facts? The facts are that study of Torah is divided into two categories. There is applicable Torah, those laws that can be put directly into practice, on the one hand, and everything else on the other hand. A woman is obligated to learn applicable Torah. Indeed, a woman recites the very same blessings on Torah study that a man does every morning. Has commanded us to occupy ourselves with the study of Torah. Lasuk b'divrei Torah. She makes the same blessing that a man does. The other category, the everything else category, a woman is invited to study. She's not obligated to study, but she's invited to study it, biblically. God says, I'm not requiring this of you, but if you do it, then I offer you a reward for so doing. Now, I think it's obvious that if God obligates women to study applicable Torah and invites them to study the rest and offers them a reward for studying the rest, it cannot be that they're incapable of understanding it. God does not obligate people, nor does he invite people to do things which are going to injure them, which they're incapable of doing. So the interpretation that you will hear from certain circles simply is out of line with the legal facts. Now, as a matter of fact, the rabbis made it prohibition for women to occupy themselves in the all the rest category. And that's what we have to try to understand. The applicable category remains as it was. But it's a question of the all the rest. Let me just give you an idea of what goes into the applicable category. The applicable category includes all the laws of kashrus, all the laws of prayer, all the laws of lashon hara, of not slandering or degrading other people. All business law, because women are fully competent to conduct business just as men. Laws of interest, for example, on which there are fat volumes calculating every different possible way of making a profit and different contracts and different conditions and clauses. Shabbos laws. The amount of applicable material is really endless. Complicated. Sophisticated. The implication here of any intellectual deficit, if you are investing your lifetime, as Polskim do, basically, investing your lifetime in applicable terms. Now, the rest category for women is optional. It's an optional mitzvah. What is the status of an optional mitzvah? We have two types of mitzvahs, obligatory and optional. An obligatory mitzvah, God says, I order you to do this. If you do it, you get a reward, and if you don't, you get punished. An optional mitzvah is an invitation. God says, I invite you to do this. If you do it, that's great, you get a reward. If you don't do it, I don't mind, you can leave it out, it's okay with me. Which would be the higher mitzvah, the more important mitzvah, the more valuable mitzvah?
Mandatory mitzvah?
Number two.
Yeah. So I think those who have not studied Jewish sources will share the natural intuition that of course the optional mitzvah is higher. Doesn't the optional mitzvah show your dedication and your understanding and your desire to reach beyond yourself and to give willingly and so forth and so on? Jewish position happens to be the opposite. The Jewish position is that the obligatory mitzvah is more important, more valuable, more significant than the optional mitzvah. Why would that be? There are two reasons that are given. One is psychological, and I think every red-blooded American will identify with this. If somebody tells you that you have to do something, has a natural desire to rebel. Don't tell me what to do. Get off my back. I live my own life. Resonate? I think so. So, if the Torah says you must do this, there's a resistance that you have to overcome to actually bring yourself to do it. And you get reward for that resistance, for overcoming that resistance. That's one explanation. Another, more philosophical explanation is this. Look at it for a moment from God's point of view. Which mitzvah is more important to him? A mitzvah that he makes obligatory or a mitzvah that he makes optional? It's obvious that the obligatory mitzvah is one that God really wants done, so much so that he orders us to do it and says, if you don't do it, I'm going to punish you. An optional mitzvah is one which God says, if you don't do it, it's okay with me. So obviously, from his point of view, the obligatory mitzvah is more important. Now, we are encouraged, to whatever extent possible, to look at the world the way he looks at the world, because the way he looks at the world is the absolute truth. The way we look at the world often falls short of the absolute truth. So if the obligatory mitzvah is more important to him, then it's more important to us as well. Making it obligatory is the signal that this is central and crucial for our spirituality. Making it optional is a signal that it's peripheral. It's peripheral. It's a nice addition, but we can do without it. And our efforts should be apportioned appropriately to whether it is optional or whether it is obligatory. You have a mitzvah of sukkah. The sukkah, in order to eat bread or a certain amount of cake, some say wine, you must eat it in the sukkah. Everything else is optional. You can have meat and vegetables and fruits for another meal, cheese and other things outside the sukkah with no penalty. It's nice if you eat it in the sukkah, but it's not required. How much effort should a person expend to be able to eat meat in the sukkah? Not a lot. Because it's optional. A person who, for example, will sacrifice an hour's Torah study going to and from the sukkah in order to eat meat in the sukkah will be very questionable. Torah study is not optional. And this is an optional activity. Why are you sacrificing Torah study for eating meat in a sukkah? So everybody has to apportion priorities according to whether the mitzvah is optional or obligatory. Now, for women, the study of all the rest category is optional. Since it's optional, it therefore is not central. It's not central to their spirituality. It's not central as a bridge to connecting to God. It's optional. And therefore, not too much time and effort should be invested in from their point of view. Now, what is this all the rest category like? In our times, for various historical reasons, the all the rest category has become centered on the Talmud. Almost everything else women do study. The whole of the Tanakh, very complicated, subtle parts of the Tanakh, the book of Isaiah, the book of Job, with commentaries, which most of your Talmudically trained Jews will find baffling. But the Talmud has become the repository of all the rest. Now, the Talmud is such that a casual acquaintance will lead a person to misunderstand and value the Talmud inappropriately. A friend of mine had an interview with a young woman who was studying at the Hebrew Union College here in Jerusalem. She elected to take a Talmud class. They're not required to do that, but she elected to do so. And the professor said, "I have chosen tractate Sukkah because this tractate clearly illustrates just how silly the Talmud is." And indeed, in 14 weeks, 3 50-minute sessions a week, I can make it look silly also. I can do the same thing for physics. Any subject which is complicated, deep, and subtle, which is given a light and prejudiced presentation, can be made to look silly. Now, someone who misappreciates, misvalues the Talmud, is going to then hold the entire tradition in contempt, because all of our law and much of our philosophy is based on the Talmud. So, here's the risk. The risk is for a woman who says, "I know that this is peripheral. It's not central. I'm not obligated to do it. But it is optional, and it's optional with an invitation. So I'm going to answer the invitation. An hour a week." An hour a week is not too much for an optional mitzvah. "An hour a week I'll study the Talmud." That's going to be a disaster. Because with an hour a week, she is going to read so many things that are peculiar, strange, difficult, which would require an investment of hundreds of hours to be able to appreciate, that she will inevitably come to hold it in contempt. So, under those conditions, the rabbi said, it would be better not to teach the Talmud to women. Of course, there may be exceptions. And there are poskim, decisors, who say that if a woman happens to be an exception, for whatever reason, in her circumstances, then indeed, she may be able to do so. But you don't create public institutions for exceptions. It would be decided on a case-by-case basis. And that is the reason that there is a prohibition against teaching Talmud to women. And by the way, this is only the Talmud per se. Quotations from the Talmud or citations from the Talmud are perfectly permissible. Indeed, the Chumash, the five books of Moses, Rashi's commentary, Rashi quotes the Talmud right and left. There's almost no group that says that women can't learn Chumash with Rashi. In all of our schools, women learn Chumash with Rashi very well. I hope someday you'll be able to match their skill in reading Chumash with Rashi someday. And there are quotations from the Talmud right and left. It's only the Talmud per se. Now, if you have, this is my last point on this topic, if you have a Greek attitude towards the world, where intellectual endeavor is inherently superior to physical endeavor, if you are proud of being an economist, and would look down on being a plumber, which is really a Greek attitude, then you might find this discriminatory, that women are given less access to pure intellectual achievement. But that's not a Jewish point of view. Our great ancestors, the models of the Jewish religion, many of them engaged in the most menial occupations. The patriarchs were shepherds. In ancient society, shepherd was one of the least trained, least skilled occupations. It was the lowest of the low. Didn't bother them. Rabbi Yochanan was a shoemaker. Nobody looks down at Rabbi Yochanan because he earned his living making shoes. Hillel, for a period of time, chopped wood. He chopped wood to earn his living. Nobody looks down at him because he did that. So from our point of view, whether your activity is intellectual or whether it is physical makes absolutely no difference. The question is, what is the spiritual quality of the activity? And that's defined by the mitzvah. If it's an obligatory mitzvah, then it is central to your spirituality. And if it's an optional mitzvah, it's peripheral for your spirituality. That being the case, women have always understood that since this is optional, it's not obligatory, therefore it's not worthy of a great investment. And the rabbi said, if it's not worthy of a great investment, and there's danger in a superficial brush with the Talmud, it's better that they shouldn't do it. You'll tell me that men also often get only a superficial brush with the Talmud. And they do indeed come to hold it in contempt. That's absolutely true. It definitely happens. It happens in our schools sometimes, certain parts of the population. And it's a failure. And it's a failure that has terrible consequences. But for men, they don't have a choice. Because for men, it's obligatory. So we have to try. If we fail in a certain number of cases, that doesn't relieve us of the obligation of trying. Whereas with respect to women, there is no such obligation in the first place, and therefore there's no reason to run the risk. That's the position vis-a-vis Talmud study. 3 minutes to discuss, and I've got to go on to the next subject. Yeah.
I have trouble separating between applicable and non-applicable study of Torah, because like aren't there, like say like the tractate on Kashrut, Brachot, like isn't everything in the Talmud written to be applied?
It is written to be applied, but it's not directly applicable. I'll give you an analogy. It's like if you want to become an excellent cook, would you study chemistry? Food chemistry? Probably not. What you do is study the way chefs have put together various foods to create dishes with various tastes. Now, food chemistry really is the underlying reality. But by studying chemistry, you're not going to improve the foods that you prepare. It's not directly applicable. Though it's theoretically part of the explanation of what's going on. The Talmud, especially in our times, there's 1,500 years between us and the Talmud. No one should ever decide any law from the Talmud, ever. Because, as I say, there's 1,500 years between us and them. And therefore, it's not going to be applicable for, certainly for us now. Right? What's applicable for us now is the codes that have come down based on 1,500 years of discussion since the Talmud. Yeah. Very good. No, no. There you're talking about a question, a doubt as to whether or not I have an obligation. In other words, there's an obligatory rule, and I don't know, let's say, whether I have fulfilled it or not. So then I don't know whether I have to go back and do it because I didn't fulfill it, or whether I'm free of the obligation. I have a doubt as to whether I have an obligatory mitzvah to fulfill. Here, there's no doubt at all. I know the law 100%. This is optional. So there's no doubt there. And it's optional. It takes the status of an optional mitzvah. The person who takes an hour to go to the sukkah to eat the meat is doing something wrong. And you don't say, because it's fear of heaven, therefore it becomes right. Because he's putting a wrong priority on this kind of mitzvah. Yeah.
Where does it come from that
that's optional for women? There's a verse, v'limadatem osam b'neichem, and that verse applies, it says that you should teach your sons. There's another verse that says you should teach everybody similarly to make all the mitzvahs known, and the contradiction is resolved by saying one is applicable and one is... all the rest does not be happening. Yeah?
You were commenting that intellectual labor and physical labor were held in equals in
right.
Jewish thought, and you gave examples of Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Hillel that nobody looked down on them for their physical labors, but people don't look up to them for their physical labors either. That's not why they're held in higher esteem. It's because they're of their intellectual labors.
No, they're held in higher esteem because they were tzaddikim. Because they were very righteous and spiritual people, not because of their intellectual labor. No, not at all. One, another example that I've got to go on to the subject is a Kohen. What does a Kohen do all day in the temple? A Kohen in the temple? Well, he's slaughtering animals and catching the blood in a bucket, and then he's pouring it on the altar and flaying off the skins and butchering the animal and taking out the entrails and checking that they're kosher, and then he's carrying up the limbs to the altar and putting them on the altar so they should burn up. What do you think he looked like at the end of the day? A mess! Blood and dirt and entrails and everything all over him. Right, you say, but this is the temple. This is holy. Right, that's the attitude. This is holy. This act, this activity, which in other cultures would be one of the lowest that you would assign to anyone, here, because it's in service of God, becomes holy. That's the defining characteristic. Is it in service of God or not in service of God? And that's defined by the mitzvah that God puts on. Okay, that's study of Torah. Now let's take testimony. Here it's a little more tricky, but the same thing, the same result will come out. You will hear in certain circles that women are invalid as witnesses. Why would that be? That women are invalid as witnesses? It's got to be one of two things. Either they're too stupid to tell the truth. They just don't know what's happening. They can't speak straight. You know, you can't trust them to describe things in an accurate way. Or they're evil. You know, they're vicious. They lie. They lie, they cheat, you know, and therefore you can't trust them. And therefore it's clear that the Jewish religion regards women as stupid or evil or both. QED. No, for a feminist, that's enough. It's all over. But if you look at the law, you see that the law doesn't support this view at all. Because, first of all, in Jewish testimony, there are two different goals. I don't know of any other legal system that has this idea, but the Jewish testimony, there are two different goals. One is to establish the facts, and the other is to trigger punishment. These are two separate goals. It is possible in Jewish testimony to establish the facts without triggering punishment, without triggering court action. We would naturally assume that once the court knows the facts, it will act on the facts. That's not true in Jewish testimony. Indeed, I have a chance, I'll fine-tune it a little more, but this is at least roughly accurate. That's good enough for us. So, for example, let's imagine a case where two witnesses say they saw Reuven kill Shimon. And the court questions them, cross-examines them. What angle did you see it from? What was the murder weapon? What was he wearing? What time of day was it? And the stories are complete and accurate, and they agree in every detail. And then it comes out that the two witnesses were standing in such a position that while they were watching Reuven kill Shimon, they couldn't see each other. How could that be? Let's imagine that they're in an apartment looking down the street, and one witness is in the kitchen, and one witness is in the dining room, and there's a wall in between them. They're looking down on the street, and they're watching Reuven kill Shimon. So we say, just a moment. There's a wall in between the two witnesses? So then, the court is not mandated to take action. Now, why is that? Because suddenly we don't trust them? We don't believe them. We think their testimony is inaccurate. After all, they were watching the murder. They shouldn't have been looking at each other. If they were looking at each other, I'd be worried that they didn't know what they were talking about. No, they're walking, looking at the street. But if there's a wall in between them, they don't mandate court action. Why? No reason is given. No reason is given in the tradition. It doesn't mandate court action. Another example. Reuven kills Shimon on the street. 27 witnesses come pounding into Besdin, into the court. We saw Reuven kill Shimon. Wow, 27. So they interview all of them, and they cross-examine all of them. And then it turns out that one of the 27 happens to be Shimon's uncle. Oh, an uncle. Relatives are not accepted as witnesses in a case concerning the relative. Good. So Shimon's uncle is out. So are the other 26 out. Why? Because they came together with the uncle. So all 26 are dismissed. All 27 are dismissed. Why? Because the other 26 came with the uncle. That somehow makes them less reliable or suspect or incompetent in some way. No rule is given, no reason is given for this, no explanation is given for this. If the group contains one who's a relative or who's disqualified for some other reason, the whole group is disqualified. Another example. Relatives themselves. Why is a relative disqualified to testify about his relative? Is it because we suspect that he will not tell the truth? Maimonides says explicitly that that's not the reason. One proof of it is that even if the relative comes to testify against his relative, we don't accept him. Another proof of it is that if I know the witness loves the person he's testifying about or hates the person he's testifying about, he's not disqualified. We don't suspect that Jews are going to lie in court on the basis of who they love and who they hate. So why is the relative disqualified? Says Maimonides, it's a rule without an explanation. No explanation is given for it. No reason is given for it. They're simply disqualified from mandating court action, from causing the court to act. The king cannot give testimony in court. He's disqualified. Kings don't give testimony. Certainly not because we suspect it to be too evil or too dumb to provide accurate testimony. So, in this category of mandating court action, there are many exceptions. Exceptions for which no reason is given, and the exceptions carry no implication whatsoever about a person's intelligence or a person's truthfulness. Now, this is where women are excluded. They are excluded from mandating court action, just like relatives, just like a group that contains relatives, just like witnesses that have a wall in between, and just like the king. Since that is what they are excluded from, the explanation cannot be a lack of intelligence or a lack of trustworthiness, because in this category we know there are exclusions that have nothing to do with either intelligence or trustworthiness. We have no explanation for any of the exceptions, and we have no explanation for the women being accepted. So whatever the explanation would be, it's not that. That's point number one. Point number two, we do know that a woman's word is acceptable to establish fact. For example, we have a rule. To establish the ritual status of any item, all you need is a credible statement. Is this meat kosher trade? All you need is a credible statement. You don't need two witnesses, one witness will do. And a woman's word is just as good as a man's. And indeed, we will take action on the basis of her statement in a case like this. One woman says the meat is straight. Two men see Reuven eat it, the court will prosecute. Because to establish that the meat is straight, all you need is the statement of any credible witness. Anyone whose statement is credible creates the fact. And a woman's statement is as good as a man's. So if it's a question of establishing fact, we know that a woman's statement is as good as a man's. It's just that in Jewish law, there is this extra qualification that's required to mandate court action. And that indeed, there are many exclusions, including women being excluded. So the explanation that's given is simply an incorrect explanation. There's no question about women's credibility. A woman's credibility is just as good as a man's credibility. Only in mandating action, you need more than that. That's testimony. Finally, the complaint is made that since Jewish law in its entirety is mastered only by men. Therefore, when there are legal decisions to be made, the men are the ones who are the decisors. And because it's only men who are decisors, women are thereby disadvantaged. Now, this complaint comes in two flavors. There's the radical flavor and the moderate flavor. The radical flavor is that men use their authority to control women, degrade them, keep them in a second-class status. There is a war between women and men throughout all societies, the war of the sexes. And in Jewish tradition, men have a tremendous tool by which they can enslave women, because they are the decisors and they can use their power to determine Jewish law to keep women in secondary status. That's the radical form of the complaint. The moderate form of the complaint is men could be as fair-minded and generous and sensitive as they are capable of being, but men systematically misunderstand women. They don't fully understand who women are, what they need, what they want, how they see the world, and therefore they're going to make mistakes in trying to do for women's benefit. They may be good-hearted and fair-minded and dedicated to doing what's right for both sexes equally, but they will fail because they don't understand women. That's the moderate form of the complaint. Now, Meisman here has a very revolutionary approach. These complaints are made and motivated politically. And anybody who knows which side the political bread is buttered knows exactly what to say. Meiselman, in a revolutionary approach, says, let's look for evidence that these complaints are true. Evidence. That is a word that is never heard in these discussions. It's never raised. Because evidence is not relevant. What's relevant is to show how good you are and how politically correct you are by taking the right position very stringently, very strongly. But let's ask for evidence. Let's try the radical form of the complaint. Men are using their power to decide Jewish law in order to enslave women. Could there be evidence for such a thing? Is such a thing possible? Could we conceive of evidence? So Meisman says yes. And here's how you do it. There are 5,400 plus pages of Babylonian Talmud. In that work, every legal consideration, every legal subject is given discussion. Some has direct relevance to women. Some does not. Now here's what you should do. Take the area, which is the majority, that does not have direct relevance to women, and analyze it. Analyze the reasoning. Analyze the methods of proof. Analyze the standards of authorities that are appealed to. Come to a picture of the logic of how Talmudic law is decided. Then turn to that portion that deals directly with women's issues and see whether it's the same logic or a different logic. Prejudice shows itself in corrupting a person's logic. Prejudice shows in that the standards you use for other subjects, you don't use for the subjects you're prejudiced in. So, try to show that when it comes to women's issues, the standards of proof change, the types of authorities that are appealed to change. And in that way, you have evidence of prejudice. No one has ever claimed such a systematic difference between Talmudic logic in general areas versus Talmudic logic in areas that apply to women. No one's ever claimed it. Not the most radical feminists, not the great scholars of the conservative reform movement. No one's ever claimed it. The reason they haven't claimed it is because it isn't true. One reason it isn't true is because everything is cross-referenced to everything else, and everything is argued out in terms of its reference to everything else. But if so, if there isn't any difference in the standards by which women's issues are discussed and others' issues are discussed, then you have no reason to assert this kind of systematic prejudice and victimization that they're claiming. So here is a way that you could get evidence for this claim. And no one has ever even asserted that the evidence exists. And the reason is yes, evidence doesn't exist. Well, I suggest to you, although this is politically very unpopular, I suggest to you that if there isn't any evidence, that people ought to stop asserting it, even though it sounds great on the demonstration platform and whip up the crowd and you get tremendous cheers when you say it. If there isn't any evidence for it, then you ought not to say it. Okay, that's the radical form. Now let me come to the moderate form. What about the moderate form of the complaint? Yes, men are fair-minded, and they are good-hearted and sensitive, and they would like to do the best for everybody, but they just don't understand. And since they don't understand, they're going to make mistakes. Let's ask Meiselman's question over again. Is there evidence for this? Could there be evidence for this? Of course there could. This is child's play, just that nobody does it, because it's decided politically. So what do you need the evidence for? Here's how you do it. One way. I have two ways to suggest. Other clever people will think of a dozen other ways. Take a videotape of a woman portraying some idea, some value, some feeling, something, without words. Have her act it out. Show the videotape to men and to women and ask them, what is this woman trying to portray? If, let's say, she's portraying anguish, show it to 100 women, 75 women say anguish, and 20 women say unhappiness, and 5 women say depression. And show it to 100 men, and 25 men say she's expressing joy, and 25 men say she's expressing aggressiveness, and so the men are completely off the track. You would have evidence that men don't understand women. You'd have evidence. This could be done. I'll bet you could get a contract from the government like that to do such a project, because they will think they know the answer before it happens. Another possibility. Take men and women who are therapists, psychological therapists, and catalog the types of problems they deal with when the patient is a woman, and see if female therapists are systematically more successful in treating women than male therapists are with the same problem, if you could compare diagnosis of problems, which is difficult. But anyway, it's a theoretical possibility. Try it out. If women are better at treating women's problems than men are at treating women's problems, that would be some evidence that women understand women better than men understand women. But, as I said, in the political climate that we live, no one even asks for evidence. It doesn't even come up. Which should show you the bankruptcy of the kinds of discussions that go on. Okay. But it's worse than that. It's worse than that. If you did such a survey, you would be talking about the general public, the ability of the general public to understand women, general public of men. We're not talking about the general public. We're talking about the creme de la creme, the very, very top of Jewish scholarly and spiritual achievement. Those are the decisors for the generation. You're talking about a thousandth of a percent of the population. So even if in general women didn't understand, men didn't understand women well, that would be no proof that these men don't understand. Furthermore, as I suppose you've heard by now, traditional Jewish families tend to be large. That means that this little boy, who grows up to become a decisor, grows up with quite a number of siblings, a gigantic number of cousins, and they play together and talk together and interact with one another. And then, of course, he'll be married, because it's an obligation for a man to be married, and he'll have his own children. Furthermore, the decisors of Jewish law, the vast majority, are in constant contact with the women of the community, because women go to the decisors just as men do to get answers to their problems. Indeed, half a mile from here, there's an institution called the Beis Horah, the house where Jewish law is administered, and there are scholars there around the clock. It's a free service. There's a men's waiting room and a women's waiting room, and they alternate and go in, and they go in and ask their questions. So these men are approached by women to ask their questions, to pour out their troubles, to get advice, just as much as the men. These are not scholars in a think tank someplace. These are people who are responsible for a real community. And that includes the women in the community. Now, somebody says, in spite of the fact that this is the creme de la creme, spiritually and intellectually, and in spite of the fact that they themselves come from large families, and in spite of the fact that they are responsible for a community and have constant contact with the women of the community, and in spite of the fact that we saw last time that in our tradition, a woman's point of view is taken very seriously, in spite of all of that, they still claim that these men don't understand women, then they really do owe us some evidence. I don't say it's impossible. I wouldn't say the evidence I'm offering in favor makes it impossible that these men don't understand. It's still possible, but goodness gracious, we have a lot of reasons to think it isn't so. If you think in spite of that it still is so that they don't understand women, you owe us some proof of that. And the proof should not be, we as women want X, and they said no, that proves they don't understand women. It's a little bit like affirmative action, you know. If there's any difference in the way one group or another group gets treated by the system, that's proof of discrimination. Could be an indication that the groups are really different, and not that there's discrimination going on. So if the attitude is, we want X, they're not giving us X, that proves discrimination, that will certainly be disqualified. One has to show on the basis of the sources that are being administered that it simply isn't so. Just to review briefly, then I'm going to take questions for a few minutes. In the radical form of the complaint, I think it's totally without evidence and it's totally without foundation. In the moderate form of the complaint, it's conceivable that it's so, but there is considerable evidence against it, so someone who wants to continue to claim it owes us better evidence than we have against it, in favor of it, that it is so that these men don't understand women. Yeah.
Don't we have some evidence right in front of us? Which is the American justice system. You have women decisors of the law judges and male judges. You can go through all of the decisions, they're readily available to you for free, and see, is there a prejudice there? Is there a difference? Do they decide, you know, cases that are better, you know, with women as litigants or defendants?
Well, I think this is a very good idea. This is a very good idea. Of course, you're not talking about Jewish decisors. You're not talking about a spiritual criterion. But it's another interesting idea. See whether there's a discernible difference between the decisions that on the Supreme Court that the women have written and the men have written. Try it blind. Take the names out of the decisions and ask, give 100 decisions, and ask students to classify which are written by women and which are written by men. I will bet anything that they'll never be able to do it. They'll never be able to pick out who's the woman and who are the men. Unless she signs it inside, you know, that as a woman I say X, but if it isn't so, on the basis of the reasoning of the decision, they'll never be able to discover it.
Two quick ones. One is, in line with this, shouldn't that show that women just want the right to be able to serve such a position, not necessarily that men are looking at them in the wrong way, you're taking a different approach, saying that men don't understand women, right? Women are saying, we want to be, we know that maybe men do understand us, but we want the right to be in that position as well. One thing, and the second thing is, again, these might be out of context or whatever, but these are a few things I just pick up, like quotes from the Gemara, which say things that kind of could be horrible about women, like women are like vomiting or what, and women are kind of dies, you know, something like that. So maybe they're out of context, so I'm not going to finish.
Well, this is very interesting. Let me tell you, I have a friend who wrote a book. I've been quoting Meisenman's book the whole time. There's a fellow named Kaufman, Michael Kaufman, lives in the Old City. He wrote another book, which is longer than Meisenman's book, based on it to a certain extent, called The Woman in Jewish Law and Tradition. Also a good book, published by Jason Aronson. And he approached me about this problem. He said, there's something like 15 or 20 statements in the Talmud which are very derogatory concerning women. What shall I do? Shall I claim it's out of context and so forth and so on? I said, no, that's not the approach. Take a look at the statements that are derogatory about men. And he found a good 15 or 20 that are derogatory about men. Men are snakes and men are all thieves and men are all liars and things like that. So now, and he puts them in a paragraph, one paragraph after the other one. This is what it says about women. This is what it says about men. So what are you going to say? When it says about men, it's exaggerated or it's only to make a point and so forth and so on. So the same thing will be true of what it says about women. It comes out that the things that's said about women are no worse than the things that's said about men. Michael Kaufman. It's published by Jason Aronson. It's called The Woman in Jewish Law and Tradition. So it is true, but of course, your feminist sources will only quote the ones that are derogatory to women. They won't quote the ones that are derogatory to men. Now, your first question was, this is very interesting. You say, leave aside the complaints that I described. But it's just a question of wanting the right. We will talk about the value of freedom. Rights, from our point of view, are not self-justifying. It is not, from our point of view, appropriate to grant a right, to give a right, to work for a right, to defend a right just because it's a right. The question is, what will be done with the right? And indeed, will what's done with the right be of any value or not? If it's not going to be of any value, then for us it's not worth a nickel to support it. Now, what defines whether or not this right will be of value? What defines it, from our point of view, is the mitzvos that determine what is valuable in terms of achieving spiritual goals for which people were created.
But women are depressed because they can't serve such
dreams. Who are depressed? Psychologically depressed, you're saying? And what about men who are depressed because they can't have the neighbor's wife? So what do we say to them? We say, listen, I'm sorry, but your depression is on the basis of your being out of step with what the Jewish tradition defines as valuable, and you need help. You need sympathy and consideration and help. Well, you don't change the tradition because you're depressed. If there were a claim of oppression, since the Jewish tradition itself is concerned about oppression, then you could claim perhaps that there's an internal contradiction and we have to take account of it. But the minute you step outside the tradition and look at it from the point of view of alien values, then it's not an attack that we have to take account of. Yeah.
Is this just a rumor, or is it correct that the more Orthodox are looking at women as deciders for certain issues? Women's issues or business law or whatever.
Look, the truth is, in our times, being a decisor of Jewish law is a matter of scholarship only. Once upon a time, there was also a legal authority that was ordination that went back to Moses. We lost that about 1600 years ago. So today it's really a matter of knowledge. And if a person is knowledgeable, you go to them and they tell you what to do. It's no question whether it's a male or a female. Just typically, since women don't invest in the non-applicable parts of the Torah, they can't be considered scholars of that kind. And indeed, there are women who are trained to represent other women in court, and they are considerable scholars, and they are heard by the court like any representative for a litigant. So in these areas, there are women who are trained and who are fulfilling these functions. Quite right, yeah. Last question, we got it out. Yeah.
What do you think about the Nishmat, I think it is, the program where they're training women to be a lot of the authorities in Nida because the women don't feel comfortable going to men, so sometimes they'd rather not go. Like, there are cases apparently where they'd rather not go and be embarrassed in front of a man.
Well, I don't know about the program in general, but as you're describing it, it is completely pointless. There is no reason for a woman ever to go before a man for the laws of Nida. Never.
It's the man that... Well,
number one, the man, and it's by the question, there are nurses. One of my best friends, his wife is a nurse and a midwife, and she does the examinations, and she reports the examinations to the rabbi, and the rabbi gives the decision. No woman has to go before any man for the sake of the laws of Eden. So if that's the motivation, it's absurd. It's absurd. Nowhere does a woman have to do that. If she finds it embarrassing, it's very easy to circumvent that. Okay.